It's always exciting. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Film Hustlers.
Hey.
Hey, guys. How are you? Hey. Good to see everybody.
Always good. Hey,
listen, if you listen to the show, go give us a rating, right? Well, Apple Podcasts.
Yeah.
1 to 5. Or put a review or go to the Instagram and slide in
actually
there.
Actually, subscribe. We need subscribers. Oh, that's the most important thing.
How do you
thing.
Subscribe?
You click the little thing on the purple little icon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you subscribe.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, more subscribers.
I'm going to go subscribe.
You don't come on.
I don't think I have
the
yet.
The host of our show does
After
not
4 years.
4 years, I didn't know where to find the button at.
I know, that's what she said. Wow.
But, check that out and give us a rating and give us a review. Tell us what you think. Just so you guys know, we are having a screening this Saturday.
That's right.
And we're screening Beautiful Darkness, which was directed, written by Tootie. And
who's Tootie?
And produced by Davey Dave, myself.
Be safe.
Yes, sir.
So shot on film. So if you guys want to check it out, send us an email or
let's try that again.
DM.
Slide into the DM.
Oh shit! I always forget.
Slide into the DMs.
Let us know. You can come. Also, we're going to be at the LA Shorts International Film Festival on the 20th.
5:30.
5:30 p.m. LA Live. If you're
Regal
around there,
Cinema, right?
Yeah, Regal
yes, sir.
Cinema. Come
That's
on
right.
in.
Yep.
Roll through, check that out. So every time we have a guest,
Roberts gets really
we've
nervous.
We've had great guests.
We've had great guests.
And I think that's what makes me nervous. You know, especially today. We got Rusty Cundiff here. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here, Rusty.
Now I'm nervous because you've had all these great guests.
Yeah. No, there's
not
pressure on me.
No pressure. I remember all of your movies. You know, I remember Tales from the Hood. I remember Sprung.
So I take all the blame.
It's a great movie, dude.
Yeah, those are all movies that you went to theaters to watch. Tales from the Hood, Sprung, Fear of a Black Hat. All these were extremely well received.
Chappelle Show. Directed some Chappelle Show episodes, too.
Some Chappelle.
And we're an actor. That's but what we like to do on the show is we like to go back to the beginning. You're probably the most educated filmmaker we've had on the show. You went to SC.
That's frightening on many levels.
I did go to SC.
Where were you born and raised?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And, you know, not a big film town. When I was there, actually, it's kind of come up a little bit. It's a little bit more of a film town now.
Nice.
What were your dreams and aspirations about Hollywood when you were there?
Probably more on the performing side. You know, I started out somewhere in high school, was doing jokes and being goofy. And then start doing stand-up, like, probably right in my last year of high school and after, you know, somewhat in college and stuff like that. And
cool.
And acting. So I came from, you know, the performing side.
Yeah.
And you know, slowly slid into writing and directing.
That's pretty impressive. Nice. Stand-up in high school.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know adults who can't, you know, they get the fear of going up there, but you're a high schooler going up there
in front
of people?
Well, when you're young, you're stupid.
Right. You don't care. Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, it's weird because I'm not like a party person. I don't go to parties and cut up. And I would have been called shy, but on stage, you get a microphone. And you're kind of in charge. There's a little bit of an armor if you have enough wit. Somebody comes at you, it's easy. You know, the audience is almost always on your side unless you're really a piece of you know what.
Yeah.
So it's not too hard to kind of make your way through as a stand-up. And I always kind of looked at it like, you know, people go, oh my God, I'd be so scared and this, that, and the other. Like, the only thing that ever concerned me when I was on stage doing stand-up is if someone that I knew well was in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Because these other fools, I don't know, I might never see them again. Who cares if they laugh or not? But, you know, it's always the one day that your buddy or a cousin shows up that you have a bad set.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, really, it was a bad set. And they're like, yes, I'm sure it was. When someone comes to see you do stand-up and they know you, they have, you know, their preconception is who you are day-to-day in the world, which is not necessarily who you are, like you say, you know, up on stage. And in fact, you know, I remember when I would tell my dad, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. He'd just go, I don't hear you do any jokes around the house. You're not funny here. You know, and I'm
That's
like,
funny. Well, dad had comedy. Look at that.
Dad was funny. Dad had some jokes.
Yeah.
So in the 80s, there was lots of comedians that were performing in comedy clubs when they were under 18.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you have any inspirations when you were starting out?
All my inspirations were, you know, I was a huge Richard Pryor fan. Yeah, who wasn't? Yeah. George Carlin. I had all of those albums. Mm. I could recite those albums from the beginning to the end. And, you know, even Red Fox and, you know, stuff like that I was into. But, yeah, George Carlin, Seven Dirty Words.
Yeah, all that
Richard
stuff.
Richard Pryor, Mudbone.
Yeah, yeah.
I could, and I would perform those bits for friends and, you know, some Bill Cosby stuff. But I like the dirty stuff better.
Yeah.
And, you know, and who knew Bill Cosby was actually even dirtier?
He was dirty. Yeah.
What's a record? You know what those
yeah,
are?
They had, they,
yeah, what's a
that's,
record?
That's how you had to listen to comedy back in the 70s and 80s. You had to put on the comedy album.
Yeah, you know.
Like a tape or CD or I don't know how you just stream it now.
Yeah.
But so you went into comedy. You were doing comedy when, like, I don't know, that was the golden era of comedy.
Yeah, that was the time that all these clubs started to open across the country, and every bar had a comedy night, every country western. I mean, some of the places I went to perform, I wasn't, forget being on stage and being nervous, just going into a club when you see gun racks and antlers, and I'm like, who booked me here? I don't know if this is my audience at all. But, all the yuck yucks and chuckles and ha-has and goofballs and all those clubs.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just going around the country and you stay in the comedy condos. That's what they would call them because they would have so many comedians coming through. They would just, the club would buy or rent a condominium. And you just come in after the other two or three acts, and those things were hell holes, of course, because, you know.
But how did you figure out you weren't going to stay in comedy?
I ended up, you know, acting and doing stand-up. And then I started getting a few gigs as an actor. I ended up on a soap opera for about a year or so. I was on Days of Our Lives, playing a detective for a short period of time. I did a couple of sitcoms. But in that period, I ended up as an actor in Hollywood Shuffle, which was Robert Townsend's movie.
Yeah.
I ended up in School Days after that, which was Spike Lee's movie.
Yeah.
So I'm watching both of these guys who are writing and directing their projects. And while I was at USC, when I was at SC, it wasn't the George Lucas, Steven Spielberg version of USC. The film school was in a funky ROTC building on the side of campus. I think they let like six students into the film school. I was a philosophy of religion major. That was
my
took drama classes and other stuff.
Right.
But anyhow, so while I was there, I also saw, I would go to Arthur Knight, who used to write for the LA Times. He was the big film critic for the LA Times. And he had a class that I took where he would show movies, and he would have sometimes a star, sometimes a director, sometimes the producers would come in after the movie and they would talk about it. And John Sayles came in. So between seeing John Sayles, who talked about Secaucus 7, and then working with Robert on School Days, Hollywood Shuffle, and then Spike on School Days, I started to write. There was an actor on Days of Our Lives, and he would go into the wardrobe room in between, you know, rehearsal, and I'd hear him clack, clack, clack. This is back when people had typewriters. Clack, 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 clack. I'm like, what are you doing in there? He's like, acting, yeah. I like to write scripts. I mean, it's creative, you know? So between those four things, I started to write, and I really loved The Big Chill. Lawrence Kasdan's The Big Chill.
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah, and so I was writing a kind of black, African-American, Negro-colored version of
The
Big
Chill.
That's tough.
Yeah, with all these characters in it. And that I was doing kind of while I was coming out of School Days, and then that script started to get me some meetings around town, which was kind of interesting, because no one really, you know, you can't just send your script cold to anybody.
Right.
So my buddy and I had a buddy who had actually helped produce a film with Vincent Price called A Whisper to a Scream or The Offspring, which I think is where the band took their name from, The Offspring. Mm. But anyhow, so he had helped do that, and I hooked up with him, and we created a fake company called Silent Storm Films. So that way, when my script went out, it was going out from a producer
right.
of Silent Storm films.
That's the way you get around it.
Yeah,
you gotta be a producer.
And then they go, well, you know, producers aren't as batshit crazy as writers, so we'll read your script.
Right.
And you don't have to sign that crazy thing that says, we probably have something exactly like yours, and so you can't sue us when we do something exactly like yours.
Exactly, right.
So that's how we kind of got around that. From that, I ended up getting the gig to write House Party 2.
Right.
Because Reggie and Warrington were having their issues with New Line and didn't want to do it.
And that was big, dude. Yeah.
House Party was a huge really one. Yeah.
New Line was huge.
The house that Freddy Krueger built, right?
Yeah.
New Line, yeah. House Party spawned a bunch of new talent, too. Yeah. Who was in there?
Oh, well, you had Martin Lawrence was
Martin
in that.
Lawrence was
obviously
in there,
couldn't play, but Robin Harris, the comedian, who passed away now, but... what's her name, who ended up on Martin's show?
Tisha Campbell.
Yeah. That's the thing I miss most, I think, about the 80s is people could make a movie, and even if it was a low-budget film, you could get some action. Like, I remember Hollywood Shuffle being a big inspiration to all of us trying to get into film. You were like, oh, it could happen. You could do it. You could put everything. Because I remember the story like if it was yesterday. He put all the movie on credit cards mm-hmm. and did whatever he had to do to try to get it made and got a bunch of publicity. And I think the film did really well in the box office, too.
I mean, I think it did well for... You know what it cost. I think it was a Samuel Goldwyn thing, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
I think it did pretty well. It was funny because I was actually in Atlanta working on School Days as an actor when Hollywood Shuffle came out. Yeah, that was just amazing because down in Atlanta, probably one of the first black films to really have a large budget behind it for some years, and I'm down there with all these young 20-year-old kids like myself with per diem.
Having a great
time. And a bunch of pretty people in a hotel all staying there.
It was
wild times.
You made it.
Yeah, it was, and then I get to go on the weekend while I'm shooting a movie and see myself in a movie.
Right.
Yeah, which was,
No, that was
didn't get much better.
Those are exciting times, man. And you were like in the epicenter of it all. Like you got Spike Lee, you got Robert Townsend, you got all these comedians that are on their way up. When did Fear of a Black Hat come to you? How did that happen?
Fear of a Black Hat happened the kind of black Big Chill thing that I did. I shot a short for that. We got short ends and shot it on 35, old school stuff. And but we never really could sell that. And then somewhere in there, I was a big Spinal Tap fan. So I was obviously into hip hop and the rap scene at that time, just
Public
as a person.
Enemy.
All of the early coming up kind of out of the late 80s into the 90s groups. And so it just seemed like something. I'm like, I can do I'll do like a rap Spinal Tap and I'll do it kind of like Robert, So we went out, we shot kind of a sizzle for it, but it was like a 20-minute thing. That we shot on 3/4 inch because we're like, we didn't even sell the short end thing, 35, you got to process it. So we went to Compton Cable, which one of the community cable things, right?
Cable,
and as long as you say that you're going to put it on their service, they would give you the equipment.
Yeah.
And so we get this equipment and we're shooting, 3/4 inch tape. And cost us about $600 and we had about 20 minutes and we had some of the songs that actually ended up in the movie, like Booty Juice was in there and My Peanuts was in there, which was kind of like my Adidas Run DMC. And we shot that thing for like $600 put together, edited it at Compton Cable. Of course we didn't show it there because you couldn't show it. They looked at it like, whoa. That we started to just take around and show to people. And I would say it was, people kept saying, oh, this is kind of funny, but you know what? Hey, Chris Rock, do you know who he is? I'm like, well, of course I know who Chris Rock is. Well, he's getting ready to do a rap Spinal Tap, so yeah, go away. So that went on for like a year and a half. Everywhere we went, someone would say, well, Chris Rock. Well,
what was
Chris
that,
Rock.
CB4? Was it called?
CB4, yeah. But it hadn't been done, They were just like, he's going to do it, he's going to do it. And then finally one day, back in the days of phone recorders where people would leave a message and you had a tape that played and you had to go click it, right? So I come home one day and I'm listening to my messages and someone comes on and they go, hey, you know, your movie, that it was called The Trial of NWH. NWH was not NWA. Right. NWH was niggas with hats. And Trial of NWH. And we wanna make a movie of it. So I'm like, who's effing with me? I didn't even call back. I'm like, one of my friends is obviously thinks this is funny. And then about a week later, her name was Lori Shackelford. She was at ITC out here in the valley, and she calls back and she's like, no, I saw your movie when I was working at it was a music video company. And we wanna turn it into something. We want to make a movie. And I'm like, all right. So I go out and then I learn one of the big lessons of the film business. Never tell anyone what your budget was.
Right.
Because I'm like, yeah, they're like, this is great. This is a good 20 minutes. How much was it? I said, $600. I said, you could do a whole feature for like $1,800.
Yes. Exactly.
See? Lesson. See? He wants puzzles.
See? He wants puzzles. But yeah, lesson, I'm with you.
Yeah, just don't tell him. You can do it, but don't tell him.
Yeah.
It's so weird because I'm having flashbacks of when I went to the local TV station that was on cable in East Los Angeles. It was Highland Park.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I went in there and I shot stuff and I edited stuff there and put it on. I had like a talk show.
Oh, you did?
Like, really ridiculous. Like, it's just weird. Like, when you're in a situation like that, it seems like a good idea at the time because no one else is allowing you to do anything, right? But you can go there and like they'll really let you do whatever. Yep. I think we were in a closet editing. It was all just like a nothing room. But you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep moving forward. You say in the show.
All the time.
That's what I'm saying. Shark.
That's right.
And how much did they end up giving you for the movie?
The official first budget of Fear of a Black Hat was $999,999.98. Because they're like, we are not making $1 million.
Yeah.
You know what? That's good dough.
Yeah, that's great.
That's back great then, dough, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad.
And look, full disclosure, Rusty and I just did a movie together in Toronto, a Netflix movie called Meet Me Next Christmas. And everywhere we went, there was always somebody who said, like, hey, Fear of a Black Hat. They'd even quote lines from the movie.
Fear of a Black Hat has a fairly decent following.
Yeah, cult following.
It became kind of a little cult thing. Yeah.
The title was like a playoff of...
Oh, yeah. Fear of a Black Planet.
Public Enemy.
Yeah, Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet. Yeah, I mean, everything in there was related to something or somebody. PM Dawn, we were goofing on.
Listen, I'm a big fan of Rusty. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, me too. When you look back at the 80s, the 90s, and how influential independent film was... It really was. Yep. It's not anymore in the same way. And I know that everyone's trying to find their way. And I think that's my argument with Tutti all the time, is that you could do anything back in the 80s and 90s and sort of find the nook and cranny in Hollywood and like get other stuff done and then get noticed. But it's harder now, you know, because now stuff just comes out and goes away and comes out and goes away. Like, you can't even keep an eye on what's happening anymore. But
even big things. They come and go, and the people don't even, do so much.
So then Fear of Black Hat happened. Did you get some recognition from that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Fear, we took it up to Sundance. We weren't in a competition, but we were midnight. Our first screening was a midnight screening. Apparently, we were the first midnight screening to sell out. And we were only supposed to have one showing, but after that screening, they added like two or three showings, and we just kept selling out. And that... You know, that got me obviously meetings with people around town to potentially do something else. And Spike Lee, who, you know, I had worked with in school days as an actor. Another Hollywood lesson getting ready to come up here about women and people in Hollywood. So Spike was having the premiere for... I think it was Girl 6. I think that's what it was, where all the women worked at a phone thing or something like that. And so it was up here on Hollywood Boulevard, I think now where the Directors Guild is now. So after the screening, And I'll get to the Spike part, but first the girl part. So I come out after the screening of seeing his thing, and I'm in the lobby, and there's this hot girl, you know. And I kind of come up, and she's with a friend, and I'm like, "Hey, how's it going?" And I try to talk, and it was the blow off of blow offs. It's just like I could have been a roach, and they would have given me more fucking respect, but nothing, right? And so I got the big brush off. I turn away. As I turn away, Spike comes out of the theater, and he's like, "Yo, Rusty." And I'm like, "Hey, Spike, what's going on?" He's like, "I saw your movie, Fear of a Black Hat. It was cool. What are you going to do next?" I said, "I'm working on this thing. It's a horror movie. And we're calling it Tales from the Dirt." He's like, "Send it to me. I want to produce it." I hadn't even seen it. He walks away. Yeah. I turn around smiling. These two girls are like next to me. All up in my face.
That's how it works.
Welcome to Hollywood.
David gets that all the time when you interview the right people.
Yeah. That's right.
What happened with Tales from the Hood? Did he produce it?
Yeah.
Oh,
Spike,
no way.
Spike is executive producer on all the Tales installments.
Oh, wow.
Because his contract on Tales is much better than mine.
Yeah, I'll bet.
He produced it. He was, obviously a bit different producer than you because he was further removed from the project, but similar. You know, and I give you big props, so I've told you before.
Thank you, bud.
As a producer. But, you know, Spike really ran interference for us. And one of the reasons I think that movie is as good as it is because Spike ran interference for us. And we would get, notes about things from the studio. It was Savoy at the time. We'd get notes, we think this would be better if it was like this. And I'd go, "Yeah, I don't like that idea." I would call Spike, and Spike would just call the studio and go, "Leave him the fuck alone." How's that? They wanted his name, especially then. I mean, he was a god right at that moment in time. And he was very trusting, which, you don't get from a lot of both producers or studios. He never once tried to impose his own aesthetic, his own thoughts, his own whatever on what we were doing with that film.
Yeah.
And, it's still kind of shocking to me. It was a great amount of trust that he gave for us to be able to do that, and for him, obviously, like I said, to really back us up in a lot of times when it felt like other people were trying to, tell us what we should be doing.
Clearly, you're funny, you're talented, you're a good writer, and he knew that. So that's a very cool thing. And the movie was great.
It could have blown up in his face. He didn't know,
right.
You know.
That kind of pressure works. That kind of pressure works. I don't want to fuck this up for him. The thing that I found interesting about working with Rusty is when we went to Toronto, we had our offices right next to each other, and he was, he was working on the script, and he would work on Saturdays and Sundays, which I didn't, always. Actually, not, I didn't at all.
You came through.
Every once in a while, I'd roll through. But one day, I rolled through on a Sunday, and I was sitting in my office, and I can hear like this music playing, and it was like bum bum buana, bum buana, right? First that song, and then there was like three Mr. Rogers songs back to back to back, right? I think you even had the Mary Tyler Moore song on. You did, okay.
Yeah.
So there was all
and
of
Bob
these.
Newhart.
And
yeah.
Bob Newhart. So there's all of these songs that, first of all, I haven't heard. God, I don't even know how long it's been, but I knew them really well. And it just was the most eclectic, odd pairing of songs. And I remember going in there and going like, what's
what
this playlist? And he's like, it makes me happy. What kind of space does it put you in for writing?
Well, it depends on what I'm working on. If you were to look on my Spotify playlist thing, I have playlists for various types of writing.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, wow. Yeah. So I got playlists for suspense. I got a playlist for writing horror. They're actually very different. Horror and suspense and dramatic suspense are kind of different. The one that you were listening to, I think, is just called Childhood Memories or something, but it's all these songs that I remember as a kid that just make me feel safe.
Yeah.
Because I've listened to it on the car with my parents or getting ready to go to school in the morning. They'd be on the radio, so I connect them to you know, people and situations with my family.
That's interesting. I thought it was super cool. But but yeah, we spent a lot of time in Toronto working and developing and preparing, and you know, it's and we needed five extra days.
Yes, five extra days would have been so
perfect.
Yes,
I scheduled it for 30.
We but got did you guys 25. Have pigeons?
No, we didn't have pigeons. This guy with the pigeons. We do this independent little short. He's got to have pigeons. Then pigeons
like two, costing, 2 grand later.
You needed pigeons.
I needed pigeons. And I needed to be in
homing
film.
Pigeons. Homing yeah. pigeons.
Well, not homing. No. Just like regular pigeons regular to pigeons, feed yeah. on the street. But it was. I think it was $1,800 just for the pigeons. Another $800 for the permit.
Wait, and you had to get eight. You had to pay for pigeons.
Yep. We had to pay for pigeons.
Where
we
were you shooting? The desert. They're all over the place. Here.
Right in Griffith Park. But yeah. We had to have wranglers. We had to have insurance. We had to have. It was a lot.
Animal permit.
Park animal permit. Animal yeah, permit. Yeah. Park permit. It was crazy. Well, I do want to mention too. On Meet Me Next Christmas, we are. You know, there, it's a big music movie, right? There's Pentatonix music. There's all kinds of needle drops. We have a great composer, Dara Taylor. But we are finding needle drop stuff that is from. Extreme music.
Yeah.
ExtremeMusic.com continues to be like the company that all of these other big film companies use. So, I mean, it's not even, they're more than film, they're a streamer, so they have TV and all this other stuff. But when I went to Netflix and said, like, what libraries can I use? They said, Extreme Music.
Oh, nice.
Warner. They had three or four of them, but Extreme was number one. Yeah. So, I just wanted to mention that Extreme Music provides amazing music for the industry, for television, commercials, everything, and we're going to be using it on Meet Me Next Christmas.
And the guy who runs it, he's not bad himself. He's a nice guy.
He's a founder of ExtremeMusic.com, which is now owned by Sony, but he recently did a thing at the Hollywood Bowl with Snoop Dogg.
Well, yeah, it's coming up in August.
What is it?
Or September. It's Doggy Style.
His first album.
Yeah, it's going to be orchestrated.
What?
With an orchestra. Yeah.
And he's gonna, that's awesome.
Can you imagine?
That's crazy.
Well, so I'll give you my real quick connection to Doggy Style.
Oh, I hear that.
Well, for fear of a black hat, this is one of those moments that I wish I had back. After we did the movie, we're going to release it. I was like, we need something else. So Snoop had his Snoop Doggy Dog, like his first big Snoop Doggy Dog, that right?
Oh, yeah,
remember
right.
That?
Yeah.
It's on Doggy Style.
Yeah, and so, okay, two things that you guys might remember. This is dating me terribly, but there used to be like this channel out here that was like a video jukebox channel, and you would call in. There was a number to call in for the videos that you liked, right? And they would rise. They would go, "Oh, this is our top thing. This many people called in." So I did. A song parody of Snoop Doggy Dog called Ice Froggy Frog. I still have the video for it if you ever want to see it.
I want to see it.
And it so instead of Snoop Doggy Dog, it was Ice Froggy Frog, and I was, I can't even remember, but I had all kind of, you know, frog references. He was a gangster fucking frog, and he had hose, and all this stuff was going on, right? And so we did a music video for it that's actually really funny, kind of a takeoff of Snoop's video, and it ended up on this video jukebox channel. And so one day, you know, and it could have been on MTV, but the film company and my music supervisor got in a pissing contest over who was going to pay like $400 for something, which I didn't find out till later. I'm like, you're both morons, because we could have gotten so much free publicity and you guys didn't want to spend $400. But anyhow, this thing goes on the jukebox channel thing, and the jukebox company calls up and they go, "You guys are number one.
Oh my
Everybody
God.
Loves it." And we're like, "Well, like, I guess that's cool." And they go, "You don't understand. No one has ever been number one who hasn't paid to be number one. They really just like your thing." It was
like, that's hilarious.
Yeah, but you know.
So did you write the music and the lyrics for the music that you had in your
movies?
I wrote
all the lyrics, and then I worked with composer and, you know, some other guys, and we would create. But I would tell them, I was like, well, you know, this is like this. This is like an LL Cool J thing. This is like, you know, you know, Public Enemy or, you know, whatever. And we would kind of work it out like
parodies
that.
Parodies are cool, man. I mean, parodies are cool. Oh, yeah. I don't think, right?
You've done them.
I've done a lot of parodies. I did a parody movie.
Yeah.
Again, maybe I was inspired by Rusty.
It called?
It was called Plump Fiction.
I love that.
It was a parody of Tarantino movies, which everyone was like, don't. He's already a parody. Although I got to say, like, I'm excited about the Tom Cruise movie, Mission Impossible. Yeah. Oh, I'm serious. Yeah, sure. People are going crazy about it. They said it's really good. Do you not care? Really? What do you care about? Beautiful Darkness.
I care about Beautiful Darkness.
It's a beautiful. It's a good little movie.
With pigeons.
Yeah. You understand. You'll get it. You heard of a kite bird?
So Fear of a Black Hat happens. You stayed in comedy because you ended up working on Chappelle. How did that come about? Was that through any of your connections or the people that you had met?
No. Well, that came about partially from what came before. Dave had seen both Tales from the Hood and Fear of a Black Hat.
That's amazing, and liked them both. That's amazing, though, right? Is that special when someone like Dave Chappelle says, I've seen them?
Oh, sure.
He didn't see him because he was meeting you. He saw him
on his
own.
He just saw him.
That's amazing. Yeah.
The people that I have heard, some that I know personally have seen it, and others who I've heard through the grapevine. Like, I almost did something with, were they called DreamWorks then, or still Amblin? I can't remember. But, you know, I heard the story of Steven Spielberg watching Fear of a Black Hat and singing Booty Juice with whatever wife he had at the time.
See that.
A music supervisor friend of mine was at a party where this was with Brad and Angelina were together. They were singing Booty Juice. Wow. They knew it. I've never met either of them, but you know, stuff like that, which is, you know, just, you know, kind of cool to hear.
Really?
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Awesome. I mean, these are heroes.
But yeah, with Chappelle, most of the things that I've done, and kudos to you for the movie, because that's how, you know, stuff still happens, is you go and you say, F it, I'm just going to do something, right? And you do it, and sometimes it gets someplace, and you get something out of it. It might not be what you thought.
Yeah.
So as a kid, I used to love Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
Sure. Yeah.
Which was just a goofy, you know, variety show that was just weird comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, you know, I want to do a kind of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, but I'm going to make it black. So I did this pilot that I shot for myself called the New American Negro Comedy Hour. It's like the stupidest thing. And it was just corny and weird, and I'm wearing a tuxedo and introducing stupid stuff. And
wait, you made this?
Yeah, no.
Oh, I want to see this. This is good.
I have it on tape someplace. Yeah, but the New American Negro Comedy Hour, and so I sent it to. I had a connection, but she was at Comedy Central, and I sent her. You know, I said, "Hey, we got a pilot. We could maybe work on your thing." And she calls back, and she goes, "This is really funny. We just signed Dave Chappelle to do a show that is a thing, and we can't do this and that. You want to direct some Dave Chappelle shows?"
Wow.
And that was like before it aired, you know, before it came out. And she said, "Well, we got to see if Dave is interested." But then I talked to Dave, and Dave's like, "Hey, man, I hired, what's his name? Clarence Williams III for half baked because of Tales from the Hood." I was like,
awesome.
Cool.
Let's do it.
And so I ended up, it was like, probably of one of the best jobs I've had, one of the easiest jobs I've ever. And usually there's a lot of song and dance that you have to do.
Well, TV,
he was into it.
TV directing is different than film directing. Film directing, there's 90% of the weight is on the director's shoulder. You know, it's very important to get the director to do absolutely like everything, so that vision can come through really strong. TV, on the other hand, has writers and executive producers,
showrunners, all these
other people involved with stuff. But see, the exciting part about having people tell their stories is the concept that everything you do is going to net you something from the actual work, right? It's just not what you thought it was going to be.
Right.
And sometimes that ends up being better than what the actual original plan was. I think that's super exciting. Yeah. I mean, that's why we're all here, right? At the end of the day, we're like, you know, you go to work, you pitch stuff, So then you did Chappelle, and you probably had a great time, I'm guessing.
Chappelle was, you know, watching Dave is just a treat. Because you never knew, even though, you know, you had a script and, you know, sometimes I'd throw him a couple of ideas. He'd take them if he thought they were right for him. And sometimes he'd go, nah, it's not me. But you just never knew what he was going to do. And, I learned real quick, I always had to have a camera on Dave.
Yeah.
I think on one day for something we were doing, and this is back just when the first, like, weird little HD cameras came out. Oh, it was like P something. I forget.
The DVs?
But so we had our two main cameras, but it was a big bar scene. I think one of the things of when keeping it real goes wrong, yeah. It was like a runner that we had. And I think that was that. But I literally had like eight cameras going at one time. But irregardless, I would always have a camera on Dave because he would do something and you'd ask him to do it again. It's not like he would say no. He'd do it again, but it's just going to be slightly different. It might be better. Working on that show was just, it was a blast. And plus, normal, quote unquote, TV shows, you're walking it like I did a Bernie Mac episode and I've done some other stuff like that. But you're walking into a situation where it's like, yeah, this is what we do. Yeah. You know, you go, hey, what about a Steadicam here? Yeah, we don't use Steadicams. What if we just go wide? We never go wide. You know, it's like, yeah. It's like that. Right.
This is what we do. Right. What's it do?
Yeah. So just do that. Yeah. Shut up. And here we go. Right. So, but, you know, on Chappelle and some other things I've worked on too, but definitely on Dave's show, because we were always aping something from the zeitgeist of what was going on. Everything is always fresh. You're never doing the same shots. You're never attacking the material in exactly the same way because you're like, oh, this is okay. Now we're doing an MTV type of thing. Oh, now we're doing a fake PSA over here. Right, now we're doing, you know, whatever. Now we're doing a movie that Mel Gibson was in. I think in some ways, and I've never really thought about it until this very second, but in some ways, I was learning some stuff because I was aping some really good directors. Like, you know, we did a version of The Matrix. We had a little Matrix thing. And so I had to break down that scene. And, you know, we're doing Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze and
Ghost.
Yeah, so I'm breaking down that scene. And you're going, oh, okay, well, this is how they did that. So I'm learning kind of directorial stuff that other people do while I'm actually creating something that's slightly different. And so, you know, it was, you know, that kind of stuff was just a blast. And that's so much fun.
But it's an exciting thing. And then as you move out of that, I'm sure that probably helped in some ways.
Well, and, you know, I used some of the stuff I learned on that on our movie.
Oh, cool.
So, I mean, you know, that day that we had with Deval and Christina and Kaylin, Andy was our DP on Meet Me Next Christmas. And, you know, we would get together and we had some very, very strong shot lists. We would go over them and we pretty much knew exactly what we were going to do. Kaylin was this young guy that came in and he's only in the third part of the movie, but he's just really fun. He's got a natural gift for comedy. And not to say that Christina and Deval do not. But he's just, you know, it's very organic with him. And we saw it when we auditioned him, you know. Right. It's just like, and I was like, that day, that morning when we showed up, it's like, I can remember, and Andy looking at me for a moment like I was crazy. But I'm like, Andy, we are throwing out our shot list. We are not doing the shot list. Forget that. And I just started creating tableaus that I could put these three actors in and just let it happen. And you know, we started moving the camera to facilitate what they were giving us in terms of comedy. And it's some of the best in terms of comedy in the film.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's something that, you know, I learned a little bit with Fear of a Black Hat, a little bit working with Chappelle, to how to allow people to have the freedom to go off script, to and capture it.
Wasn't the easiest conversation. Mm-hmm. It was a complicated conversation because you both had spent weeks
coming up with the shot.
Dude, we had schematics. The entire crew, by the way, got schematics. We even knew Andy was so technical that we even knew where not to put gear on the schematic. So the schematic said you could put gear here or here, but you can't put it anywhere over here because we're, that's where we're going to be shooting. So he didn't want to do a thing where everyone showed up, put stuff, and then you have to move everything.
Yeah,
so it was very interesting. Efficient. But it was really efficient. But that's the great thing about Meet Me Next Christmas is it does the last 30 pages introduces new character. New characters, it really does drive to the end of the movie, which is the thing that you want. And I think I talk about it a lot here, but I think it's the thing you want most is you want to give people that ride to the end of the movie so that they're super satisfied. I think you achieved that big time.
It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. And then the last thing I kind of want to mention is that when we were getting started in pre. And I don't know if this has to do with all the work that you've done, but you were working on two movies when you got the job on Meet Me Next Christmas.
Yeah.
You were finishing something. I had watched, you had done Divas, you had done...
Oh, right. Yeah, I was involved in two things. I forgot about that.
You were wrapping up a Morgan Freeman movie.
Yeah. It's called 57 Seconds.
57 Seconds. Great trailer. Amazing trailer.
With Josh Hutcherson from Hunger Games.
And RDP shot it. You were doing a lot of things at the same time. By the way, I liked those movies. I thought they were great. I didn't get to see 57 Seconds, but that trailer was amazing. And any time you could work with Morgan Freeman,
that was very fun.
I think you can look back at your life and say, like, you've worked with some pretty amazing folks.
Yeah,
man.
And I've been very fortunate. We had Susan Sarandon one day on Chappelle's show. Wow. That was ridiculous.
Did people want to work on it? Were they calling to be on the show?
By the second season, if that's how we got her, I was like, how did we get you?
how are you here?
Yeah, my kids love the show.
Yeah.
And that's her two kids happens. Show up looking like Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
And
that's hilarious. Well,
that sort of thing.
I'll say this. I'm really excited for people to see Meet Me Next Christmas. It's not going to be till the next Christmas, so it's going to be a minute.
Meet you next Christmas.
Meet you then Christmas after. Well, we had a good time. I thought we did a good job. I'm looking forward to what you're doing next. Hopefully you can come back and, we'll talk about this movie again when it comes out. And you may have another movie coming out before we get to Meet Me Next Christmas.
Well, if these strikes ever end.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah.
Well, the actors ever decide anything? Have we heard?
Tonight at midnight.
We'll find out. Right.
So by the time you guys hear the show, we'll know if the actors are on strike. But bottom line is, producers and studios, and it's mainly the streamers, have to step up and do something because it's not going to go away and people need to get back to work. But Rusty, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you guys.
Thanks for talking about your career a little bit. It's amazing what you've done, and thanks you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
See you next time on Film Hustlers.
You almost forgot the title again.
Dude, I always forget the title of the show.